If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, I'm stand-up comedian James Mullinger and the co-founder of Edit Magazine. This is Mullinger Meets Canadians, the podcast where we meet Canadians who are making waves on the world stage. In this episode, I'll be speaking with stand-up comedian Travis Lindsay, the most prolific writer in East Coast comedy. He's been captivating audiences with his incredible mix of jokes and storytelling since the tender age of just 16. Travis was named Best Nova Scotia Comedian on Bell TV's Comedy Bootcamp in 2016, and then went on to win at the CBC Hubcap Comedy Festival Open Mic Contest, which was broadcast on Sirius XM globally. He's also appeared on CBC many times and at the Halifax Comedy Festival. He also hosted the 2020 African Nova Scotian Artist Awards. He recently released his debut comedy album, The Kid Is All Right, which went straight to number one on the iTunes comedy charts. We talk about his life, career, and what it was like being a stand-up comedian while you're still in high school.
My mom has set such a high standard for the crazy bullshit she'll text me sometimes that when I don't get it, it really disappoints me. And what I do when I get those special texts is I save them, and then I wait until my album tape and I read them without her knowledge. I got this from my mother on a Thursday at 10 o'clock at night. Just saved a raccoon from the dumpster. That's the most normal sentence you're gonna hear for the next 10 minutes.
Travis Lindsay, mate, how you doing?
Good, man, how are you?
I am bearing up. It is lovely to hear your voice, and it was lovely to see you finally last week. We obviously did a show together, outdoors, socially distanced, in Truro, Nova Scotia. How did that feel for you, being back on stage?
It was good. I love, you know, it was definitely, you know, I've done a couple shows in the last couple months or so with things opening back up, but that was... That one, you know, felt definitely special and probably like the most normal out of all the shows I've done recently. So that sense of normalcy was nice to have back.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I think what we discussed on Friday night that we found so fascinating was the fact that, you know, we're in this position where these gigs, which traditionally wouldn't have been things, they wouldn't have been top of our list of things to do. You know, people all spread out, outdoors, broad daylight. But suddenly now, I mean, for without wanting to use that dreaded phrase, the new normal, this has kind of made us, you know, realize what it actually takes to be a stand-up comedian.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And then, you know, I think we have the added bonus of, like I was telling you, that, you know, the people are kind of starved for some sort of like live entertainment, and that where normally they probably would have took that for granted, you know, having us perform outside and whatever, want to chat with each other. But, you know, having them literally sit next to the people they've been stuck with for 6 months, you know, they didn't really want to talk to them.
Yeah, that's true. They've been trapped in that bubble. And so now we have their undivided attention.
Yeah.
And I mean, and you mentioned obviously that you've been doing shows lately, and you've been one of a handful of people across the country that have been very proactive in mm-hmm. getting out there to do, you know, obviously distanced shows within clubs, but also you were doing fire pit shows, garden shows. Where did that kind of drive come from to get out there and get back to doing the job that you love?
More or less just out of, honestly, like depression of not doing shows. And, yeah. You know, it was the longest I had gone without doing stand-up since I was 16. So, I mean, you know, for all the sense, it essentially was like, you know, Keith Richards going sober. I think it was on the verge of like killing me had I not gotten right back to it. So, yeah. You know, I kind of jumped in and took whatever opportunities I could to perform in circumstances that I would normally dread.
That's a very good point. I mean, I think also, do you think that because of the fact that here in the Maritimes, we don't have this built-in kind of star system, this built-in industry, we've always kind of had to fend for ourselves. We've always had to make stuff happen for ourselves. Do you think that in some ways that made it easier for us to transition into being performers in a global pandemic than it possibly would be for someone in Toronto or Montreal or LA who's just used to the phone ringing?
Oh, absolutely. I think, yeah, this is not the most unusual circumstance for us. I mean, this is kind of like, it almost felt like summer started way earlier, because usually summer around here is our dead season, you know, for a lot of us, and people are on vacation then. We're a big tourist city, so, you know, people aren't coming out to the clubs and that, so you really got to kind of like hustle to get work in the summertime, and it's just felt like it's been July since March. So I think like a lot of people, you know, kind of get kicked in the ass and get kicked into gear and motivated to keep going. Because I think a lot of people are just terrified of getting rusty and forgetting how to do this.
That's it. I mean, you are known for being extremely prolific when it comes to writing jokes. And by that, I mean, I've never seen you do the same set twice. And it's incredible how your material evolves. Were you able to kind of use that lockdown time to write, or did you just find it all too depressing?
No, I definitely found time to write, or at least, you know, jot stuff down to like kind of keep track of things going on and things to write about. It did get hard, I would say, around like, you know, a month without doing it, and kind of was getting to me, because I felt like I'd forgotten how to do stand up.
Right,
yeah. Like I would like listen to like audio recordings of sets and stuff and be like, I can't do that. I don't know who that person is. I don't know how I got there.
Yeah. It's true. It's like going back to the beginning, isn't it? It's like, you know, because normally, as you say, you wouldn't go more than a week or at most 2 weeks without doing a show. So suddenly four months is like starting again.
Yeah, 2 weeks without a show, I feel like a bum. So like, you know, a whole month I was, those nerves grew back and the fear of failure and, you know, a lot of shit you got to work out. But thankfully, things are kind of picking back up.
Yeah. I mean, people that have seen you perform would think it was surprising that you would feel nerves, A, because of your presence and your confidence on stage, but also quite uniquely, you started, and you mentioned this earlier, very young. You started at 16. I mean, you know, I think Seth Rogen and Chris Rock are kind of famously two of the only people that kind of started in their teens. What do you think it was that, I started at 26, and that still feels slightly early. You know, Ricky Gervais, for example, didn't start till he was 40. Like, people often start this later in life. My wish is that I'd started earlier. What was it that spurred you on at 16 to know that this is what you wanted to do?
Arrogance and bitterness.
The two traits of all comedians.
Yeah, my origin story started very young. I had auditioned for my high school improv team, and I didn't get in. And I thought it was because they didn't think I was funny. But at the time, they saw me more of like a single performer, not like a group performer. But I took that as they didn't think I was funny. So I signed up for the talent show, and I just kind of jumped in with both feet. And I entered the talent show at high school, and I won.
Wow, amazing.
And, you know, I was kind of hooked on that adrenaline and high from it. I mean, I still, like, vomited before the show and, you know, debated knocking out a tooth so I didn't have to do it. But, you know, once I got up there, I was like, I didn't want to leave. So that was kind of, this was my first hit of this heroin called comedy.
So do you remember that feeling, what that feeling was like being up there when the first laugh comes and you know, was it kind of this moment of clarity, do you think, where you were just like, I need that hit as much as possible for the rest of my life?
Oh, absolutely. It was, you know, it was that fear. And then I got that first laugh and it's like jumping out of a plane. And then like, you know, the parachute worked. So I was like, okay, here we go. We're kind of floating now. We can kind of, this isn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. There's, you know, there really is no fear. I mean, bombing sucks, but you learn that that's not the worst thing in the world.
Yeah. You're right. It's funny, isn't it? People think that, you know, how you overcome bombing is by having more great gigs. But the reality is the more times we bomb when we start out, it's far better for us because we realize that, as you say, it happens and then nothing doesn't mean anything. Doesn't, you know, you walk out of there and it's done. And I find that, you know, it's I find a lot of what is considered the what people think this industry's like and this job is like, it's often the opposite. You know, and that is a perfect example of one of those things.
Oh, yeah. No, most definitely. Yeah, I don't think I always think bombing is a good thing. It means you're trying something different or, you know, I mean, you know, it's not always the audience. And, you know, most times it's not the audience, but sometimes it's the audience. And I think people got to stop being the moment you not stop caring about the audience, but the moment you stop caring about the opinion from the audience and you're just yourself and you kind of, you know, accept me for who I am, you know, I think that's a much better place for a comic to be.
Yeah. When did you feel that transition? Cause you're right. That absolutely is the moment when you're up there and you're not just standing there thinking, love me. And you just go up there and do you remember when that kind of shift happened for you?
Yeah, it was pushing 3 years in, so it would have been about 2012, One Night at Yucks. I used to be terrified of any kind of oohs or ahs, and I didn't want to, like, ruffle any feathers. So, like, anytime I felt like, you know, they're pulling back on me, I would immediately kind of give in to something more friendly and upbeat, and so they would, you know, kind of like me. And I just remember one amateur night, there was someone up before me, and they just laughed at something I thought was kind of hacky. And I just kind of, pardon my French, I was kind of like, you know, fuck these people. I don't want you to laugh at me. Yeah. And then for some reason, they ended up laughing harder that set. And it kind of felt good. Like, it felt like this release and this tension was kind of like eased up. And yeah, that was kind of like the first little click into just being, you know, more of myself up there than I thought I was already being.
Yeah, but basically being less, as soon as we're less self-conscious about anything in life, we're going to be better at it. And that is the key, isn't it? Who were your comedy heroes growing up, do you think?
Growing up, the biggest ones in the stand-up format for me prior, you know, was my like first real introduction to stand-up and the rawness of it. Eddie Murphy, you know, Chappelle's probably the biggest influence. You know, my teen years, definitely, you know, it's kind of controversial to say now, but at the time, Louis C.K. was, you know, a big one. But yeah, definitely, you know, prior Chappelle, Eddie Murphy, those were like the three big ones.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, all the greats. I mean, do you find it for yourself, do you find it harder to talk about kind of race and racism living in a place like the Maritimes than it would be in a more kind of, you know, diverse place?
I used to. I would definitely say before this started, I used to, and probably my material is more curated to making them feel comfortable about it than myself. And I think now I find it easier to do it in places like this, even though I'm, you know, some people are kind of like, you know, are kind of reserved and, you know, a little tense when it comes to entering those kind of subjects around here, because I think a lot of people want to think that, you know, we have like we're a perfect friendly place with no issues like that. But, and I think now I think it would be harder for me in the city where people are just going to clap and agree with you than have like an actual real emotion to whatever you're saying. So, I think on both ends, on an end of having a good fun show not go awry, yeah, it's kind of harder. But in a sense of it meaning more when it goes well, I think, yeah, it's easier to do here.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, the beauty of it is, of course, that it's not your job to make the audience feel comfortable. It's your job to do great stand-up, and that's what you do. And I guess, conversely, do you feel in some ways a responsibility, especially now when, you know, obviously, as you touched upon, there's been this misnomer here for a long time that we, you know, we don't have that problem here, which, you know, I think now is starting to change. And again, it's one of the many great kind of offshoots of the Black Lives Matter movement, that people within a place like the Maritimes are starting to realise that we do have this systemic racism. It is everywhere, and just because it's less diverse here doesn't mean those problems aren't there. Do you feel that in some way, do you feel responsible as kind of the Maritimes kind of only working black stand-up comic that you have to do that stuff, or do you just want to do the stuff that you... No, will make them laugh. What's your, you know, kind of, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think I kind of have to address that elephant in the room. I think, especially with my style and storytelling and, you know, a lot of personal stuff in my act, I feel like I do have to address it, or else I'm kind of just doing a disservice, and I may be, you know, perpetuating the idea that there is no problems here. And it's like, well, he's happy, he's not complaining about anything. Right. You know, so I feel like there is a responsibility for me to kind of like at least address my personal experiences with that stuff on stage. And, you know, if I can add humor in, for sure, it, you know, that's always the first thing I want it to be funny. But if I can get a point in there across too, and maybe kind of open some minds when people leave the show, then yeah, I think that's a great thing. I mean, don't get me wrong, I want to talk about stupid shit like pizza pockets and that too, but you know, if I can make some serious shit funny, that's really important to me.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the incredible thing. It's a difficult thing when you have this job that you're amazing at, this job that you love, but then you do have that kind of you know, essentially this kind of weight of responsibility. But at the same time, you have found this impeccable way, as so many great comedians have, of addressing it in a way that is very kind of, you know, well, I mean, a perfect example is first time I saw you live was you know, at Bailey's in Halifax. I was sitting with your mum, or close to your mum, and you have that amazing line, which I hope I'm not spoiling this for people who are going to buy your album after this. But you say, I come from a pretty mixed race family. My dad was black. My mum was curious. Absolutely amazing. One of those just perfect jokes, which, you know, I mean, as comedians, we are constantly trying to you know, get to the laugh as quickly as possible. That is, it's less than a dozen words. There's like three levels to that joke. There's also a lot of information in there, and it was wonderful to sit there and watch this kind of whole room fall about laughing, and also to be sat there with your mum in hysterics as well. That was a wonderful night. You know, for those kind of jokes, like, do you, where does that come from? And then how do you kind of whittle it down to something kind of so tight and so pithy?
I think really just luck more than that. Like, I would love to say that, like, you know, I was like, oh, boom, but like that was something, you know, I really crafted and whittled down. I think I just shot it out on stage one night in a riff, and then I was like, okay, well, this is like a good opener, you know, tester joke. We can see where we're going with the crowd and how they respond to that bit, for sure. And then we can kind of see where they're at, and I can kind of curate everything else to fit that vibe. But, yeah, I think, you know, it's just life plus time to think about, you know, life and, you find a way to carve it into something that gets your point across.
Yeah. It makes sense. It's fascinating to me because it's what I love so much about your style of joke writing is, like I say, it is that very kind of tight nature of them. You know, I often, you know, curse myself for kind of having, you know, build-ups that are too long or all of those things. You know, and I think it's interesting you said about how the fact it was a riff on stage one night, which again, that's something which people don't realise, that, you know, it's hard to sit down and just sit and go, I'm going to write a joke. Half the stuff that we ends up in our act is stuff that just comes out of our mouth one night, or we go up there with a premise and then start talking, and it's literally just based on audience reaction, you know, what becomes a kind of a permanent bit in your show.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's almost impossible for me to sit down and write out a bit. You know, I used to script my stuff, and then I just found I was, you know, now I'm just reading words that I wrote at a time, and they're not being performed with whatever emotion I'm feeling that day. You know, there are some bits that I've done while happy and sad and whatever, and that kind of all reflects it. And, you know, you learn how to make it work through all that different stuff. And I think you become a stronger comic when you have, you know, a good idea of what you're doing. You have an act to fall back on, but you're kind of just up there being yourself is, to me, the most important thing. And I find that's where the best jokes come from.
Mm. So true. I mean, your album, The Kid Is Alright, is just a fantastic example of this. Just incredibly, you know, tight and hilarious and beautifully recorded album. And of course, you know, went to number one on iTunes earlier this year. How did that feel? Did that feel like kind of a validation? Especially, as I say, like, you know, in this part of the world that we're in, people told us that we couldn't do what we want to do because we live in the Maritimes. How did that feel for you?
Yeah, that felt real good. I mean, I remember the day of just like kind of constantly checking like iTunes and to see it crawl up. Like, I was just like, if I can just hit one for at least 30 seconds, you know, I'll be happy and I'll feel like I kind of did something right. And, you know, especially around here, you got to take any credits you can get. So I was like, if I can beat this one French guy with his 10 albums constantly up there, I can.
Who is that guy?
I have no idea. That's the most frustrating thing. I mean, you know, there's like Canadian comedy, which is like Toronto, Vancouver, and out west. And then there's us. And then there's Quebec's got their entire own world. It was a good feeling. It was something, you know, proud of, and I'm sure some people probably popped on there like, who the hell is this guy? I've never seen this guy at, you know, one of the 10 open mics with just comics in the audience. It was kind of like reassuring that, okay, maybe I can give this a good run here. I don't need to live somewhere else, you know, although that debate's constantly in my head about moving somewhere else.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, lots of people obviously, I mean, have left, and you are one of the a handful of people that have you know, stayed and made a successful career of it here. You know, what are the best things? And I mean, I guess everyone kind of knows what the difficult things are about being in any creative field here. But what are the positives about doing what we do here?
I think one of the things definitely is the stage time that we do have. We may not be able to do, you know, 3-4 shows a night, but, you know, at least here in Halifax, there's pre-pandemic, there was, you know, a show going on every night. So if I really wanted to, I could probably get on stage, you know, once a night at least. And at least then I'm not getting on for just like 2 minutes. You know, I'm usually, you know, I can get like a 10-minute set every night and do it in front of at least a couple actual audience members. And for the style that I do, I found that so much more helpful than when I did live in Toronto. And, you know, yeah, I could do 10 mics a night and, you know, really whittle down and work on, you know, my quickest bits. But I wasn't creating a, you know, an hour of work or a headlining set. I was creating, you know, showcase, just little showcases sets. And I think that can only do you so much for so long?
Yeah, that's so true. It's funny because people often say it to me about, you know, there must be so much more stage time in London. And I guess, I mean, when I was starting out, there was... You know, if you're Mike Wilmot or Sean Collins or established comic, yeah, they can do 8 gigs a night. But I was signing up for open spots and it would be 8 months away because there were so many open mic comedians. And then, you know, on 8 months would arrive and I'd have waited 8 months for this gig and I'd turn up and then it would be not happening because not enough people had showed up or you'd be performing for just comics. And as you say, I mean, here there is this definite kind of grassroots approach movement where also, you know, we get to play to bigger crowds. This is what I think I realize quite quickly here, why people get good so quickly in Atlantic Canada is you get to perform for decent sized audiences sooner. Whereas I think in London, I mean, you would never be performing for more than 50 people probably after 5 years. And yet, you know, there is the chance here to do, obviously, you know, I mean, when there was obviously Yucks in St. John or Yucks in St. John's, Newfoundland, and obviously hopefully Yucks in Halifax will survive. But there is those opportunities to play. And it's such a different beast when you are learning that craft, because when you're performing to 6 people, it's not really a test of the material. And it's not a test of you. And you're not really learning to be a comic. You learn to be a comic in front of, you know, 30, 40, 50 plus people, right?
Yeah. Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, those help you learn how to survive the rough nights. But yeah, they don't help you play to bigger audiences. I think they can help you with confidence and self-esteem. I always found smaller audiences what make me nervous. I'll happily do a show in front of 1,000 people and, you know, not worry at all. But a show with like 15 where I can see every single person's face, I find so intimidating.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's definitely the scariest thing. And people think it would be the other way around.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people do. A lot of people think, you know, does like big crowd make you nervous? I'm like, no, it makes me feel fine. Cause you know, if you're doing a show in front of 1,000 people and only half of them laugh, that's 500 people. You know, you do a show in front of 15 and half laugh, that's like 7 people, which sometimes can be funny and amusing for your own sick needs. But
that's right. That's true. Are you working on a second album? What's your kind of a plan for the next kind of, you know, 12 months?
Yeah, I was hoping to record. Well, there goes an alarm. There's my actual wake up time.
sorry, shit, we got you. We did get you up early. So that's got to stay in because that is an insight into the comedian's life. The people.
I guess for
listeners, it is 3 in the afternoon. No, it's not. No. it's 10:24 a.m. So Travis Lindsay wakes up at 10:24 a.m. That's a respectable. Actually, no. Sorry, it's 10:30. It's a respectable time for. We all know comedians who literally stay in bed till about 6 p.m. So.
You
know, and that's not even during a pandemic.
No, this is a regular Tuesday afternoon.
Yeah,
pre-pandemic, I was planning on recording something this year. I wanted to record another album. I felt like I had enough material to burn. So my set list and what I planned on having for the second album is all there. I just need to find time now to be able to, you know, enough venues to work on it and get it polished up enough to feel comfortable recording it. Because there's some stuff on there that I've not performed in months. There's little things here and there that I've done at the shows I've done, but for the most part, I've done mostly new stuff. So I guess the main thing I'm thinking about doing right now is just at least an EP of more topical stuff that I'm probably not going to be able to do in, you know, 6 months to a year. That I'm kind of like proud of that I've written during quarantine that I would, you know, just to have out there since, you know, I'm not going to be able to keep performing it anyways unless I, you know, kind of change it totally.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. When do you think people will be? Because right now, you know, I mean, people, it's a novelty to be out, for us to be performing. It's a novelty for audiences. When will COVID joke fatigue set in? I mean, I think we've still got 6 months at least. But
4 months ago.
You think it was 4 months ago? People are sick of it, and they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear when they come out. They don't want to be reminded. Is that what you think?
Yeah. I think, yeah, specifically, like, you know, I mean, again, you know, nothing is totally hack if you can get a really good, fresh approach on it. But, you know, yeah, COVID joke, I mean, they're going to be hard to be original and, you know, something that your aunt hasn't already posted in a meme on Facebook. I mean, I think when people go out, they want a bit of the, what was the normal world before than anything. But if you do bring it up, you know, you just kind of, it's really just got to be really funny.
Yeah. I mean, and that's a very good point. What's fascinating about the fact that no one's been obviously performing, and of course now it's starting to happen now, but traditionally when anything happens in the world, you know, and comedians are all kind of writing about it, suddenly everyone's coming out and there's lots of people with the same joke. I mean, I remember in England when they stopped automatically giving out plastic carrier bags in grocery stores, and every single comedian from Lee Evans through to, I mean, dozens of other, you know, big name arena comics through to every open spot came up with the same premise of, you know, you're buying 50 things and they say, you know, would you like a plastic bag, and oh no, I'm going to carry all these inanimate objects. Like, everyone came up with it, and again, no one stole it, they all just came up with it at the same time. When suddenly the clubs reopen, it's going to be interesting to see how many of us are going, oh, I've got the exact, okay, I got to drop that. Like, there's going to be a lot of crossover, isn't there?
Oh, there's going to be a huge amount of crossover. And yeah, and I, you know, that'll be the thing for where you can see where comics at, where he's like, okay, fine, I'm not going to do it, no big deal. And other guys will be panicking, being like, no, I fucking need this 2 minutes. So I'm going to do it right after you even just did it. So. We're hyenas and we all kind of just jump on the same carcass trying to get the biggest scrap of meat. So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, that's a perfect way of putting it. I love it. I mean, well, I mentioned earlier kind of, you know, how prolific you are in terms of the turnover of material. Do you think that is also potentially a benefit of being in a place where people are coming back to shows a lot, in that a comedian in England could be traveling the country doing the clubs with the same 20 minutes for a decade, and some do, some don't, but some do, and it's not considered a problem. They've honed that 20, it's perfect. Whereas when you are performing, I know you travel all over and you perform all over the place, but you perform in Halifax a lot to stay fresh, to stay sharp, and I'm imagining lots of people are coming back to see you time and time again. I mean, that's must force an incredible work ethic on you, where you're like, I'm performing at this venue again, the audience might be the same, I need to have a new 10, 20 minutes for next week. Is that another benefit, would you say, to being here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, yeah, the turnover rate that, you know, at least I personally feel I have to do is high. And I think even that stems back to starting in high school, when my audience was just my, you know, my high school. So it was the same people every single show. So every time there was a coffee house or a talent show, I had to have a new, 10, 15 minutes. And I was, you know, that was the arrogance of being 16 and thinking, oh yeah, you just write, you know, new sets every time. You don't need to worry about crafting stuff because it is the same audience. So I feel like, you know, once I got out into the real world of comedy and was around people, and then, you know, I personally just get bored with material easily, and, you know, a lot of times I'll write something and I'll do it a few times, but then I kind of put it on the back burner, and then when I get something fresh or whatever to add to it, I'll bring it back out, and, you know, then it at least kind of seems somewhat newer and or more relevant at the time I perform it. You know, I've I have material that is old, but I've only done it once or twice, and it's not polished yet, and it's sitting on the shelf until a more appropriate time comes along for it. So I have a nice reserve of preserved jokes, really.
How was your high school experience? Like, did becoming the you know, lots of people are just get described as the class clown, but you were quite literally, you were the school stand-up comedian. Did that, were you already popular before that? Did it make you popular? Did you start getting loads of girls? What was that process like?
It was, I was always, I wouldn't consider myself popular, but I could get along with everyone, you know, like, no one that was like considered popular didn't get along with me. No one that was considered like a nerd didn't get along with, like, I was kind of could travel between both worlds. And which I think makes it better for an audience. And, cause you can relate to both sides and you don't, you know, you're not coming in on a specific team. I think after I started doing it, of course, you know, most adults don't understand how comedy works, let alone kids. So, like, you do, like, two town shows and, like, you know, you should, like, send something in to Just for Laughs. And, you know, even at 16, I was, like, a 50-year-old man being like, that's not how that works. But I think it made my time in high school go a little faster, which was nice. But I also think at the time it may have been the one down point was I was the moment I did it the first time. That's all I was focused on. My co-op placements were comedy based, everything, anytime, you know, I was in plays that I dropped out of to go do sneak into clubs and do sets. My life since I was 16 has just revolved around stand up. I did it at my prom. I was supposed to do it on graduation, but they were afraid that, like, since I was leaving school, that I would just start do a dirty set. So they kind of pulled back at the last minute. But yeah, no, my high school experience was probably better than most because I had a thing I was passionate about and I had a good group of friends that supported me.
Nice. And then when did you move to Toronto and how long were you there for?
I moved in the fall of 2012 for school and, I was there, up until about summer 2014. And, you know, it was a good experience, in terms of like networking and meeting a bunch of people. And stuff like that. But, you know, going to school for comedy, I felt like, at least in the stand-up aspect, you just had to get out and do it. Which, you know, may affected my grades in the long run. But, you know, that's what I was there for. I was there for comedy, and I was really focused on stand-up.
And obviously, I mean, you know, you've grown up in Nova Scotia, Nova Scotia's home. Is that, you know, do you see yourself settling down there, living there forever? Like, what do you love about the province and what do you love about the people there?
Yeah, I do love, you know, I love it that it is certainly home for me. When I first moved back, I was not happy at the time. But now, I think, yeah, eventually, like, you know, when I'm older and, you know, more stable in my life, I'd at least like to have a place here. I just find with people, and this was the thing I noticed, you know, 6 months into living in Toronto, it's a huge city with so many people, but there are times where you never feel more alone, where here in Halifax, you know, where I live, like kind of out in the suburbs of it, is I can go for a walk, maybe run into one to two people, but they'll wave to you, they'll smile, they'll say hi. Meanwhile, in Toronto, you can go to a packed Eaton Center and people won't even, you know, make eye contact with you. So I do. There's just this more sense of home pride and people kind of coming together as a community for the most part. You know, again, we all have our problems, you know, wherever we're from. But for the most part, I find people at least kind of try to be more, not nicer, but more approachable.
So true. So true. Well, Travis, I can't thank you enough for your time. And like I say, as you know, since I first saw you perform, I've been a huge fan of yours. Love all that you do. And quite frankly, I cannot wait for that second album.
Thanks, man.
Can't wait to see it go to number one again.
Yeah, absolutely. Can't wait to do it. It was a great talking to you, man.
You too, brother. Thank you so much. Love you, man. Cheers.
Yes. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to Mullinger Meets Canadians. If you like greatness, creativity, being inspired, laughing, or just love Canada as much as I do, then this is the podcast for you. So please do subscribe and review the show now. And be sure to purchase Travis Lindsay's hit number one album, The Kid Is All Right, on iTunes now. Go see him live and also follow him on Instagram at TheTravisLindsay. Further details can be found on the Edit website, maritimeedit.com. I will see you next time.
Podstarter.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.